All right, welcome to episode 11 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I am Greg Weeks. I'm a political scientist at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. And today I'm joined by Christine Wade, who is Associate Professor of Political Science and International Studies at Washington College. Also author of two recent books, one on textbook on Nicaragua, which is in, I have it around here somewhere, sixth edition, is that what it was?
Sixth edition,
that's awesome. And another book, Captured Peace, Elites and Peace Building in El Salvador. So Christine, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
Okay, so today we're going to talk about the Nicaraguan election, which compared to the U.S. one looks fairly normal.
It does now, yeah.
And it's funny, too, because I was just Googling about it, and it seems like there was this discussion about the Nicaraguan election in the press, and then the U.S. election got going. Everyone's like, forget it. They're not. No one's even paying attention anymore.
Right, right.
Which might have been good for Ortega, actually. Everybody distracted.
Maybe. I'm currently working on a piece for WPR on the election, and I have to say it's hard to come up with something new and innovative. To say that we haven't been saying for months already.
So. Exactly. So the for anybody listening who doesn't have the basics is that Daniel Ortega won with the latest I saw, I think, was 72% of the vote for another five-year term. And his closest rival only got 16%. And his wife is the vice president. So we have a pretty clean or a pretty clear sense of domination in the political process here. And the question I wanted to start with is that there's been all kinds of shenanigans, cheating, etc. But at the same time, Daniel Ortega's really popular, and so many different economic and other measures in Nicaragua look so good compared to the rest of Latin America and certainly the rest of Central America. So, you know, how much of his win is popularity and how much of it is manipulation?
I think it's mostly popularity. And I understand that that's difficult for some people to accept, but he and Rosario are genuinely and extraordinarily popular. And it's important to remember that they're not just popular with the FSLN's traditional base, which is really somewhere around 30% of the electorate. They've managed to convert a significant swath of independent voters, which is the biggest get in the Nicaraguan electorate, as well as a few opposition voters as well.
So that leads to the next question, which is that if you're so popular and you're going to win anyway, why so much cheating?
Right. Well, I'll say I don't think he thinks he's cheating.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay, so I'll give you sort of the vantage point as I see it from within the FSLN. I don't think he thinks he's cheating. I think he thinks he's preserving the revolution. He watched the advances of the revolution be systematically dismantled after the 1990 elections. And to be real, the policies that were implemented by those governments were devastating to many Nicaraguans. He felt cheated in 1996 with the elections when he was basically told to suck it up. And accept the results even when there was evidence of fraud. I think that's one of the things that turned him off of electoral observation. And once back in power and with the institutional capacity to back it, I just don't think he was willing to take any chances. And I think if you ask people within the FSLN, they say, hey, you know what? Whoever wins the elections controls the institutions. Those are the rules. You know, we've been winning the elections and we're controlling the institutions. Very skilled at taking advantage of the weaknesses of the opposition.
Okay, so that's actually the sort of the non-cynical look, because I mean, I think I've sort of absorbed the cynical look, and maybe that's just from reading a lot of English language stuff, that, you know, he's building to be in power for life, or that he's looking the canal or other things are going to be an economic drain. But you're just saying, you know what, he thinks he's doing the right thing and he wants to keep it intact.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things about Ortega compared to perhaps some of the other leaders that he's cared to is that he certainly seems to be less motivated by personal gain than some of the others. He's certainly a lot less interested in enriching himself personally than others. I think there's room for both this narrative as well as some cynicism. in all of this. I think that Nicaragua is a fairly complex place, and that what we tend to get is one narrative or the other, and there's very little in between. And I actually think there's room in there for a more nuanced understanding of Nicaraguan politics.
Okay, and just following up real quickly, too, is that you mentioned independence. In the U.S., mm-hmm. we often talk about independence, but they're really leaning one way or the other. Is there a solid chunk of Nicaraguan voters who are truly independent?
Yeah, there are actually a fair swath of voters, about 30% of Nicaraguan voters, who are generally independent or have been up for grabs. They're not affiliated with any of the traditional parties or haven't been in a number of years since some of the opposition parties really began a pretty rapid decline. So that 30% of the electorate that we look at in Nicaragua shifts, right, a little bit between elections. And so he's managed to capture those. And remember, when he was elected in 2006, he won with 36% of the vote. Right? I mean, he was not popular when he was reelected in 2006. He won with the hard FSLN vote and a small margin of independent.
Okay.
But a lot of through what you described earlier, sort of sound economic management of the country.
Okay, so and then my next question ends up feeling like even a bit loaded, but so Nicaragua has a pretty fragile democracy. How much does mm-hmm. this damage it versus any other time after the end of the Somoza dictatorship? Now, I say it's loaded because I'm claiming that there's damage. I'm assuming that, and maybe that assumption potentially wrong?
Well, I mean, I think from our perspective as academics, democracies are better when there's competition, right?
Right.
And when all people from society feel like they have real options to choose from. And I think that there's definitely a segment of the Nicaraguan electorate that doesn't feel like they are represented in the political process. And I also think when I look at democracy in Nicaragua, and this is based on people I talk to out in the campo, you know, it depends on how we think of democracy. So we as academics or the United States government or even the Nicaraguan opposition are very concerned with institutional democracy, the perceived fairness of rules and procedures. But like a number of Latin Americans, Nicaraguans assess democracy or the quality of democracy in terms of policy outcomes.
Yeah.
So as long as Daniel performs and the economy is good and there are benefits and there are improvements, people assess that as democracy being a good thing or democracy working well, the same way as if we were to look back a few years ago to Venezuela. One of the countries with the highest level of support in Latin America was Venezuela, according to La Pop surveys. So I think that at some point we have to come to terms that when we say democracy and they say democracy, we may be talking about two somewhat different things.
Yeah, because if I remember correctly, that came out for Nicaragua really clearly, and I think it was Latino Barometro numbers. Maybe it was La Pop or it was both, where they didn't mind the nature of the government as long as the problems that they were dealing with got resolved.
That's right. And we've seen consistently in a lot of La Pop surveys, I'd be fine if we didn't have a legislature, for example.
Yeah, right.
Or the president should have more power, or I'm fine with suspending, you know, certain elements of the Constitution for securities. So I think that when we use the term democracy, when we're talking to the average voter in a place like Nicaragua, that they're not necessarily talking about the same academic issues that we're talking about. And they don't think of Western liberal democracy. It's much more social democracy.
Right. And so it's funny, you could take the flip side and say, actually, Nicaraguan democracy, according to Nicaraguans, is the strongest that it might have ever been in the entire country's history.
Well, that's the pitch, right? I mean, that's the pitch that you get from the FSLN, is that this is a people's democracy.
Yeah. But now back to the political science-y institution stuff. What checks remain now on Ortega's power?
The next election cycle.
I mean,
very, very little, to be honest. So long as he remains popular and things go well for Nicaragua, it's hard to see that there very many checks on him, in part because the FSLN does dominate the institutions in Nicaragua. And so, I mean, and this, sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
No, I mean, in many, you know, in many effects, Ortega is the ultimate survivor of Nicaraguan politics. I mean, outwit, outplay, outlast. And he's done that. And so at this point, there are very few checks on Ortega.
Now, you say that the next election cycle, but once you have control over the whole state for a long time, how much is an election a check on power?
Yeah, I think it's a fair question. I mean, and one of the things that's difficult to sort of tease out in Nicaragua is if the opposition were offering actual policy platforms that engage the people of Nicaragua, if they were choosing leaders who were engaged, if they weren't apparently so feckless and bourgeois, could they mount a really competitive campaign? That's the key question, right?
Yeah.
And it's difficult to tease out because we haven't really seen that. I mean, even in 2011, that campaign was really not a great campaign for Gadea. It was basically an anti-Ortega campaign. And the opposition has to stop being anti-Ortega and stop being something for themselves, you know, if they're really going to be competitive. But, of course, the flip side of this is, are the constraints by the CSC, the Electoral Tribunal, are they somehow prohibiting, right, the opposition from competing in free and fair action?
Right.
A little bit of both.
So,
but, you know, we did have, you know, an electoral expert report come out, and people can take it with a grain of salt. And I know, I mean, a grain of salt, and I know it means nothing to the opposition, by the way. But, you know, it focused on, you know, what went well, but also some of the things that the Nicaraguan government and the CSC could do for the coming election. But it basically reads as though they felt that it was procedurally fair.
Okay. You know, it seems like that there's a lot of research to be done on inept opposition in Latin America.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of discussion about problems in Bolivia, in Ecuador, in Venezuela, of course, in Nicaragua. But then in all these countries, you look at the opposition, which is a mess, has an authoritarian past, has no clear platform, and basically runs on anti-president. And that seems to be a pattern.
Right.
And so...
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is. I mean, but to really be competitive and to capture voters' imaginations, you have to seize on something else. I mean, you can't run an anti-Daniel campaign if Daniel's approval ratings are 76%.
Right.
I mean, that's not going to work.
Right.
So, and you can't run on a campaign and just say, well, we'll keep all those popular social programs that you like. We're not Danielle. In other words, basically validating the FSLN's economic program. I mean, you've got to do something else. And they haven't figured out how to do it.
Right. And just a follow up too, because you're talking about an anti-Danielle, but my impression outside of Nicaraguan politics is that he had co-opted a lot of the right. Is that still the case, or are there more people who are willing to kind of go against him?
Yeah, I don't know if co-opted is the right term, or the extent to which, or even the extent to which part of the FSLN project has been co-opted by the business community, right? This tripartite alliance that they have between the government, business, but really as COSEP, and labor, right? And COSEP has had a really heavy hand in drafting a lot of the legislation that has made Nicaragua more successful economically, including investment laws. You know, the private sector has been rioting. So it's not entirely clear to me that he's co-opted them to the extent that some people say that they have. I think they're very influential. And they were, in fact, influential in dialing back some elements of the 2014 constitutional reforms as well.
Okay.
But as long as things are going well for them, I don't think you're going to see a lot of disagreement. And things are going well for them.
Okay. Thinking about the international angle, after the election, the Obama administration responded with a statement of concern. In your opinion, should the U.S. be doing anything else or anything at all or not?
I think we need to be very mindful of the extensive history of U.S. intervention in Nicaragua, which was disastrous.
Sure.
In many respects, we built this, right? And Nicaraguans have a very long memory of these things. They talk about, the Marine occupation as though it was yesterday. So I think the ambassador should continue our relationship of constructive engagement. I actually think she does a pretty good job of that and of not being so interfering and focusing on our many common points of interest with Nicaragua and then hoping to build dialogue for other areas. I think punishing Nicaragua over Ortega, such as the NICA Act and some others have suggested, would be counterproductive. I mean, if you want to make him more popular, these are very good strategies.
Right.
But I don't think the goal is for us to help make him more popular.
So it's interesting. You talk about the long memory. I mean, given how deeply and how long the U.S. was involved, is that pretty pervasive across the Nicaraguan population, that strong sense of a U.S. history?
Yeah, sure. It's really part of the Nicaraguan narrative. It's hard to talk about Nicaraguan political history without talking about the United States. And there's still a lot of resentment. There's resentment for Somoza. There's resentment, as I said, for, prior interventions. There's resentment over the Contra War. There's resentment over meddling. We should be mindful that we are probably not the best agents of democracy promotion in the eyes of Nicaraguans.
Yeah, that's an understatement.
Yeah.
So then I have to ask the question of we're going to have a President Trump. Okay, and I keep saying you have to say that out loud because it's an actual thing.
I can't.
It's a thing. So what does a Trump administration look like? Total crystal ball, total speculation. Does he care at all about Nicaragua? Does he cater to the hard right in the U.S.? What do you think?
This is the great unknown because, of course, during the campaign, the sole focus was on building a wall and on renegotiating NAFTA. So we have a lot of questions about what a Trump administration would mean for a country like Nicaragua. I mean, will the administration seek to renegotiate DR-CAFTA as it pledged to do with NAFTA?
That
would be a big deal for Nicaragua. That would be a huge Nicaragua because Nicaragua has done quite well under CAFTA. Will they even care about countries like Nicaragua? Again, another great question. I do think that what we're seeing so far and some of the people who are being appointed to the transition team suggests a significant shift to the right in terms of policy towards the region. And that may not be good. But then we have this sort of odd burgeoning relationship with Vladimir Putin, who is, of course, an ally of Daniel Ortega.
Yes, I didn't actually think of that. That's true.
Russia has been really good to Nicaragua in the last number of years. Russia has given a fair amount of aid that is non-conditional to Nicaragua. Of course, Nicaragua buys technology from Russia. Tanks, like this huge controversial purchase of tanks. Is there going to be a fund nexus? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think this is the great unknown when you elect someone with zero policy experience. We really have no idea what's coming.
But yeah, you're right. I hadn't thought about the fact that with Nicaragua, you actually get a bunch of sort of contradictory things because you've got the closeness to Putin. You've got the visceral attack on Ortega as a socialist. I mean, probably it gets lumped in with everybody else by the U.S. right.
Yeah, but he's not a socialist. I mean, you can't look at the Nicaraguan economy and say that this is a socialist economy. I mean, he gets hit from both sides. I mean, but it's a liberal economy.
No, but
I mean, Nicaragua is open for business.
Yeah, I was going to say that because then the third one is that he is tied deeply into a capitalist system through a free trade agreement. So, like all of these things, you can't have one policy that actually covers all these things.
Yeah, and they've made on agreements with the IMF and the World Bank, and they, get decent credit ratings from international, readings groups. I mean, the sell that he's a socialist is really from people who haven't been paying attention to Central America in the past couple of decades. You know, that's a very Cold War perspective on Daniel Ortega. I think it's definitely a capitalist economy. It's got some strong social programs. It's not a socialist economy. But I have no doubt that, you know, Cold Warriors will see it that way.
Well, right. And because, I mean, George W. Bush had appointed people whose mindset remained in the Cold War. So, and as I tell my students, because I'm teaching U.S. Latin American relations this semester, is look at the appointees. So that's when we're going to find out whether they're Cold Warriors or not.
Right.
Okay, so the last question is that in the latest edition of your book on Nicaragua, you conclude by noting that people see a government working on their behalf. This gets a bit to what we were discussing earlier. And do you think that attitude is likely to continue?
Yeah, look, so long as the government continues to provide macroeconomic stability and tackle poverty, yes, but there are a number of unknowns that could change this, and it could change quickly. The first is obviously the situation in Venezuela. And while Nicaragua is becoming less dependent on oil and loans from ALBA, it's still a very important source of funding for the Nicaraguan government. It's what makes the social programs and social investment possible. The second question is what happens with the proposed interoceanic canal, in part because prospects of the canal have raised hopes and expectations amongst many Nicaraguans. I personally don't think the canal is a good idea. I think Nicaragua would be better served with a dry canal, but of course this isn't up to me. But the cost of disappointing on a mega project like this could be high for the administration. Of course, if it goes badly, the cost will be high. I mean, if they do attempt it and it goes badly, which a lot of the experts think that it will, that also has a high cost. And then there's the unknown that is Trump.
Sure. Just in general, though, I think with your book and even our discussion is that, oddly enough, we have all of the – well, actually, I shouldn't say oddly, but we have a lot of condemnation – particularly from the U.S. media, but I think international media, when in fact in Nicaragua, everyone's like, you know what, things are pretty good.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Greg. I work in Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Honduras, and I can tell you which one, if I was going to live in one, I'd rather live in today. And that's Nicaragua for a variety of reasons, not the least of which that it's the safest country in the region. It has the lowest crime rate in all of Central America, including Costa Rica. There are prospects for growth, for development. I'm not trying to paint an overly rosy picture.
Sure.
But if we're looking at it by comparison to the other places that I work in, you know, Nicaragua does better on most measures.
Yeah, and what is one of the countries that is not sending undocumented minors to the United States?
Right, you know? Right. Now, of course, they do send a lot of migrants to both El Salvador and formerly to Costa Rica, right? Historically, there are a lot of Nicas who travel to Costa Rica to work seasonally and travel back. But, right, I mean, they're not coming to the United States in droves the way that young people from the Northern Triangle are.
Right, because they're not suffering the same levels of violence that they are in other countries.
That's exactly right.
Okay, and with that, we are out of time. I've been talking to Christine Wade, who's Associate Professor of Political Science and International Studies at Washington College. So go check out either her book on Nicaragua and or her book on El Salvador. And Christine, again, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Greg. It's been great.